everybody hear me?
Yes.
Great. Well, welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carol Malone, the chair of the library, and it's my greatest pleasure to introduce Frances Fitzgerald and her new book, The Evangelicals, The Struggle to Shape America. Ms. Fitzgerald has been a longtime library member, and she contributes frequently to The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, and many other publications. She established her fame at the height of the Vietnam War with her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Fire in the Lake, about American and Vietnamese relations. Her other books have included America Revised, an analysis of the teaching of American history, colleges and universities, and also The City on the Hill, which is a first-hand account of the American drive to create societies which have high ideals and differ from the mainstream that most of us know. Ms. Fitzgerald has spent the last 36 years off and on writing about the evangelicals for the New Yorker magazine. And she has met a great many of their leaders, and she spent a great deal of time in evangelical churches. Reading her book, I've been reminded of what literature is supposed to do, which is to say she applies Klieg lights to illuminate the obscure corners of our little understood and often misunderstood concept of what the evangelical movement is and what it was. And she really connects the dots for us, starting with England in the late 17th century, all the way through the colonial period, the great awakenings that occurred during the 19th century here in America, and all the way up to the elections last November. Of the evangelicals, the New York Times has said, "We have long needed a fair-minded overview of this vitally important religious sensibility, and Fitzgerald has now provided it. After the program, books will be sold outside this room in the Paluso Family Exhibition Area. And I would be remiss if I didn't stand up like a preacher in a pulpit and pass the collection plate. Your membership dues here cover only a very small portion of our operating expenses. And I would remind each of you that God and I will thank you if you provide a donation to the library. We really do need your support. Sometimes I think I'm too understated in this, and I ought to testify as to the need for your support. We really do appreciate it. As a footnote, I was seated in the Church of All Souls in this neighborhood, many of you know it, at 80th Street and Lexington Avenue for 45 minutes today before a service began. And as I was looking around, I couldn't help but notice that dead ahead of me was a 5-foot marble plaque that was inscribed to one of the members of the family that gave us this building that we're sitting in here, the Clarks and Goodhue family. And I was reminded that when our library was founded in 1754, it was founded by Protestants who founded the New York Society, as it was then known, to improve the minds and lives of New Yorkers. And that we in the library, really, many of us, whatever our religions, do participate here in that long stream of effort to improve American society, a subject which Frankie Fitzgerald has written about her whole life. And I was intrigued that the plaque did not portray a motif or an engraving, but rather of a face of Mr. Goodson, Mr. Clarkson Goodhue, but rather the following words, which I'll read to you, because I think they really do resonate with what we're going to hear tonight. This Goodhue, who's Matthew Goodhue Clarkson, died in 1864. And the plaque says, you can go over and look at it, Robert Clarkson Goodhue. From his youth, he was a worshiper in this society, meaning the Society of the First Congregational Church, now All Souls over here, to which the purity of his life and his elevated Christian character were an ornament and an example. So I now present you with an ornament and an example of our society, Frankie Fitzgerald.
Thank you very much, Carol. I'm going to sit if you don't mind. I have the idea of standing for an hour and a moment. It's an enormous pleasure to be back in this library. I was here yesterday, I think. But I've been coming to it since I was a child. And when I was a child, I thought that libraries like this were places where people put a certain number of books and just kept them, and that they stayed there forever and ever. And I was sort of rather horrified when I heard that actually the library changes its books from time to time. But then it occurred to me that this is an opportunity, because wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to write a book that could be on the shelves? And you know, writers start their careers in curious ways, but this was mine. I'm going to talk to you tonight about this book of history of white evangelicals, and white is important because many African American churches are evangelical, they don't share the same history at all. Those churches are mainly about resistance to slavery and segregation, and self-help in a hostile world. And as a result, there's very little that goes on between black and white in terms of church. You know, Sunday is supposed to be the most segregated day of the year. It really, that's a whole nother book. This book is long enough as it is. I've been writing about evangelicals as a journalist off and on, really off and on, for 35 years. And it eventually it occurred to me that their history is the key to understanding them. As it is, evangelicals often seem incomprehensible, even to other Protestants. This is, I think, mostly our fault as journalists. The veteran reporter Joe Connison once wrote that the political coverage of evangelicals is a cycle of neglect, followed by sensationalism, followed by more neglect. And I think I'm as guilty as anyone else. And so, since when I began, I by accident encountered Jerry Falwell's church in Lynchburg, Virginia. I just happened to be there. And as Falwell was just starting the Moral Majority, I spent quite a long time there and wrote a piece about it for the New Yorker. A few years later, I wrote about the scandals of Jim and Tammy Baker, and that was a great deal of fun. But then I dropped it again to write a whole other book and so on. And I came back to write about the Christian right when it became a real power under the George W. Bush administration. Yet journalists are not really entirely to blame. I think most people that I know don't pay much attention to evangelicals. Perhaps they're in denial about them. Few, except perhaps you, even know that white evangelicals make up a fifth of the population, and that there are real differences among them. White evangelicals are made up of a huge variety of groups, not just fundamentalists, but Pentecostals, Mennonites, Charismatics, Calvinists, Southern Baptists, and a number of others, including one branch of the Lutheran Church in Missouri. All that unites them is the basics of their faith. And yet, over the past 35 years, under the influence of the Christian right, they have really changed the change the politics of this country. For example, religion was a very minor topic in this election, mainly because Trump hasn't any religion he's been able to convince us of. But yet, 81% of evangelicals voted for him in the general election. In the primaries, though, Christian right leaders, most of whom were pastors, came out for Ted Cruz, who was one of their own, really. And almost anyone, they thought, except for Trump. Yet after he won the primaries, Trump checked off all the Christian right boxes, abortion, Supreme Court justice, et cetera, et cetera. And most of the Christian right leaders fell into line. And now who he's chosen for his top roles in his administration. Mike Pence, who is a good conservative evangelical. Jeff Sessions, Betsy DeVos, who's yet another one. Rick Perry and Ben Carson. Those other names are very, those people are quite closely associated with the Christian right movement. White evangelicals have been an integral part of the Republican Party and making up at least a third of the votes in presidential years. And GOP politicians must defer to them, no matter what they actually think themselves. And you know a lot of Republican candidates who change their mind about abortion and other matters as they start to run for president. Well, it was not always thus, and it may not be again. Evangelical is, of course, a religious term derived from the Greek evangel, meaning the gospel or the good news. And while the word could be claimed by all Christians, it became the common name for all those affected by the revivals that swept Northern Europe and the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries. In America, the revivals were known as the First and Second Great Awakenings. And the leaders were Methodists and Baptists, who were fairly new religions at that point. Not Baptists, but in the United States they were. And some Presbyterians. And these people proselytized with great determination throughout the states and on the frontiers. Their emphasis was on simple Bible preaching and immediate conversion. And they were essentially rebels against the established churches and social hierarchies. In this burgeoning country, the established churches and the political social arrangements of the colonial period soon became obsolete. And so the evangelicals were essentially filling in for that. And after the revolution, they turned virtually all Americans into evangelicals. Why? Because there were very few Catholics or Jews here at the time. And so they turned virtually all Protestants into evangelicals. They also made America a more democratic country and created a marketplace of religion where every denomination could compete equally. This was very different from the pattern in Europe, where there was normally state churches. And because of the competition opened under pressure from them, America became the most religious country in the developed world. It was that competition that did it. In the first part of the 19th century, white evangelicals dominated the culture of the new nation, and very far from reactionaries, they instituted virtually all the reforms of the period, from the criminal justice system to care for the indigent. They created the public school system, and in the North, most of them became abolitionists. Lloyd Garrison is usually thought to be the central figure in the abolitionist movement, but that was not so, because he became too radical for religious people, and was essentially Theodore Weld, who was a convert, Charles Finney, the great preacher, who actually did the work of creating a mass base for abolition. Well, after the Civil War, the Northern Evangelicals divided gradually into liberals, or modernists, and fundamentalists, or ultra-conservatives. Most histories you read say that the cause was the modernist importation of Darwinian evolution and the higher criticism of the Bible. That was true, but it wasn't only that. The modernists were questioning many of the traditional doctrines of their churches, including the very entrenched view that the Bible could be interpreted in the same way by everyone, everywhere, at any time in history. For them, the Bible was a living thing, and it was remade always by its impact on the people who read it. They continued to emphasize social reform. This is the liberals. And during the Industrial Revolution, they adopted the social gospel, or the belief that institutions must be reformed or Christianized in order to bring in the kingdom of God. They were optimists who believed in the protection of individuals and of the society. And it was only Reinhold Niebuhr who disabused them of this notion half a century later. As for the fundamentalists, the word that meant Christians ready to do battle royal against the modernists, they, in spite of their claim to orthodoxy, also adopted new doctrines from Europe. One was that the Bible was inerrant and had to be read literally. That is, absolutely every word of it was true and literally true. Another was the apocalyptic prophecies that came from England after the French Revolution. The society was becoming more and more wicked and tending towards an imminent judgment of God. They created a whole scenario about this involving 7 years of great tribulations in which the Jews would return to Palestine and most of them would be converted. 7 years later, there would be the final battle of Armageddon between the armies of Christ and the Antichrist. And then Christ would establish his millennial reign on earth. Meanwhile, he would return for his saints, or true Christians, and rapture them into the air, saving them from the tribulations. But Israel was always the center of the prophecy. And today, most evangelicals see Israel through the lenses of the Bible. I mean, they really, Jerry Falwell takes trips there, takes people on trips there. And, you know, modern Israel is sort of not there for people. It's ancient Israel that they're always looking at. Well, the fundamentalists, preachers were educated men who preached in tall steeple churches in the cities, such as St. Louis and New York. Indeed, the doctrine of inerrancy came from the Princeton Theological Seminary. And all of this seems rather incredible to us today, but in 19th century America was a very religious society where people saw a small difference between the natural and the supernatural. They believed that science was compatible with miracles. Not everyone, but a great many people did. And even today, many evangelicals believe that God is speaking to them and that the devil is behind all they hate and fear. And when they talk about the devil, they mean a person. It's not just a force someplace, it's a person. Also incredible, or at least hard to fathom, is why such evangelicals speak of America as a Christian nation when the Constitution says nothing about it and when we clearly live in a pluralist society. Well, that's because for most of the 19th century, evangelical Protestants dominated the country, particularly in the South, where there were very few Catholics and Jews, or even liberal Protestants for that matter. And that's the society that the Christian right looks back to with nostalgia and has been trying to restore. Well, the big drama, in a way, of Protestantism came after the First World War with the clash between the modernists and the fundamentalists. The battle took place mainly within the Baptist and the Presbyterian denominations, and fundamentalists lost. After the Stokes trial, the famous court case of 1925, when in rural Tennessee, where Clarence Darrow humiliated Williams Jennings Bryan, the fundamentalists were seen by the press as sort of a rural hicks bound to disappear under the pressures of modernity. The new centers of cultural power in the United States, as the press and secular universities and so forth, forgot them or denied they existed. Meanwhile, the fundamentalist preachers, most of them separatists from their denominations, were building their own fiefdoms and using radio to extend their reach. Well, the liberals paid no attention until after World War II, when Billy Graham, then a fundamentalist, preached to enormous crowds in cities across America. A country boy from South Carolina, he preached in a slangy vernacular at first about kicking mules and people seeing Noah as a crazy old fellow with a screw loose somewhere. And but after a few years, he came into more polite society and stopped that. He was befriended by such powerful people as Sid Richardson, the oil baron, and Richard Nixon. And so he changed his flashy young preacher's suits for sort of subtly textured gray or brown suits made in London. He quoted eminent thinkers and preached a less literal Bible. Well, Graham longed for a national revival, but he needed the help of the mainline churches to have one. He rejected the fundamentalists for that reason, because he felt that they were too narrow and bigoted to help him create this much larger constituency. Indeed, he was looking for the whole country. And so he began to refer to himself not as a fundamentalist anymore, but as an evangelical. And no one objected, because the word had fallen out of use, since everybody was one, you know, or had been one throughout the 19th century. And eventually it was taken up by many to refer to all conservative Protestants who believed that Christians had to be born again and to proselytize. In other words, he created the modern meaning of the word evangelical. Well, in the 60s and 70s, Graham preached to a great variety of conservative Protestants and became a celebrity, eclipsing all other revivalists. Still, interestingly enough, the fundamentalist churches, Separatist and Southern Baptist, proliferated in the South at an astonishing rate in those two decades. Scholars attribute this to the enormous changes taking place in the South at the time, not just the civil rights movement, but the growth of cities, interstate highways, new federal regulations, and an end to the sort of intellectual isolation of the South. Well, some Southerners adapted well to these changes, but for others, urbanization and the new cosmopolitanism came as a disorienting culture shock. And among these, many turned to fundamentalist churches, looking for certainties and security in the rigid doctrines and the strict rules for personal conduct that these churches have. Well, notice how the successive waves of industrialization in the U.S., early 19th century with the awakenings, the late 19th century with the growth of fundamentalism, and the 20th century in the South, produced populist reactions. And surely there are parallels in the sort of software revolution and the globalization of today. Although it may not be expressed in religious terms, it's a populist reaction against those who understand what the changes are doing to the country and those who don't. Well, in the 20s, the conflict was over religious doctrine, essentially. But in the 70s and 80s, it was a rebellion of conservative Christians against secular humanism and all the changes of the 60s, civil rights movement, feminism, gay liberation, student protests against the Vietnam War, Supreme Court decisions banning prayer and Bible reading in schools, and so on. Grassroots groups objected to sex education in the schools, and others to the new history textbooks that they thought were unpatriotic. They weren't the only ones who thought this kind of thing. I mean, they felt that they were on to an important wave in American society. In the late 1970s, Jerry Falwell and other televangelists, all of them Southerners, by the way, picked up on these objections and campaigned with them. Falwell began the moral majority to get out the vote, and Ronald Reagan, who needed the South in order to win the presidency, supported its program, rhetorically at least. And the alliance between the Christian right and the Republican Party was made and grew closer every year. Surprisingly, abortion was only a minor issue in the late 70s. Evangelicals thought of it as a Catholic issue, and they saw the Catholic Church as a sort of medieval tyranny that controlled the lives of its believers. Most evangelicals, North and South, believed in what was called therapeutic abortions. That is, abortion is okay in cases of rape, incest, or harm to the mother, even psychological harm to the mother, which creates this broad field of possibilities for women. Well, according to the political operatives, the New Right, if you remember them, this never really entered the. They simply couldn't. Get any of these right-wing pastors to campaign on this issue. And it was only in the mid-80s, or after considerable propaganda from the Christian right, that pastors began to preach that abortion was murder. Then evangelicals became more Catholic than Catholics. Because they connected abortion with the breakdown of the Victorian patriarchal family. In other words, for much the same reason that they abhorred feminism and concentrated on what has always been called below the belt issues. Well, for political reasons, the Republicans declared themselves pro-life, the Democrats pro-choice. And if abortion was murder, what evangelical could vote for a Democrat? I won't go through the whole history of the Christian right. You know most of it, I'm sure. Suffice to say that it had some major successes, particularly when Pat Robertson, the televangelist, formed the Christian Coalition with Ralph Reed as his executive. I don't know if you remember them. The coalition organized grassroots groups to work in the elections. And in the early 90s, it controlled 18 Republican state organizations. And it used them to help take over the US Congress with Newt Gingrich as the Speaker of the House. that coalition came to grief eventually because the IRS sued it for violating the election laws, and because the attempt to drive President Clinton from office failed. But by then, however, James Dobson, a child psychiatrist and founder of Focus on the Family, a huge radio empire, he's established his establishment in Colorado, and it had its own exit from the interstate, even though there was so many people going. In addition, the Christian right was greatly strengthened when the Southern Baptist Convention, with its 6 million members, underwent what some call a conservative resurgence and others call a fundamentalist takeover. If you look at their theology, you'll see a great many strands of fundamentalist thinking in it. And indeed, they refer back to the earlier fundamentalists themselves. Well, previously, the Southern Baptist leadership had been relatively moderate and tolerant of diverse views. But after the fundamentalists gained power with biblical inerrancy as their standard, it became essentially a part of the Christian right. And many of its pastors led the way into turning the South Republican, when it had been Democratic since the Civil War. Well, the Christian right's greatest successes and its greatest failures came during the administrations of George W. Bush. The presidential election of 2000 was close, and Karl Rove attributed to the 4 million evangelicals who failed to go to the polls. Even though Bush was a born-again Christian, he received only 68% of their vote, or less than Bob Dole, which was saying something because Dole really paid no attention. Bush focused on tax reductions and his education bill, and did not press the Christian right social issues. But he brought hundreds of activists into the bureaucracy, and the White House and White House officials consulted Christian right leaders more than Reagan ever did. "We used to be throwing rocks at the building. Now we're in the building," Ralph Reed said triumphantly. Well, 9/11 made Bush a hero to evangelicals. And in February 2003, the National Religious Broadcasters adopted a resolution saying, "We recognize that God has appointed George W. Bush to leadership in this critical time in our history." Evangelicals also supported the war in Iraq, and for much longer than other Americans. The right's preoccupation was with Israel and with the conversion of Muslims. Before the 2004 elections, the Christian right, led by Dobson, coalesced for the first time on the new issue of gay marriage, because the U.S. Senate would not pass a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. Dobson and others campaigned for marriage amendments in the states, an effort which dovetailed with Bush's own campaign against John Kerry. Well, 18 states that were presented with these amendments easily passed them, but Ohio was the only important one. It was the key swing state of the whole election. And Bush won it by only 116,000 votes, or quite a lot less than the marriage ban the amendment won in that state. So the Christian right, with some justification, claimed they had won the election for Bush, and they demanded their reward, which is, of course, the nomination of conservative Supreme Court justices. From the spring of 2005 on, after this monumental, this victory for them, they could never have proved that they actually won an election for some presidential candidate before. Christian right became more radical. in one Washington conference, Christian right operatives proposed that the courts be stricken of their powers and that Justice Kennedy be impeached. Many complained that the courts were condemning Terri Schiavo, this brain-dead woman from Florida, I don't know if you remember her, to death, because the courts would have removed her feeding tube as her husband wanted. She'd just been in for 10 years in not existing really at all. But Tom DeLay, Speaker of the House, called the House back from recess to pass legislation for Schiavo, and Bill Frist, the Senate Majority Leader, rushed through a special bill for her to return her case to the courts. George Bush came back from Texas at 1 a.m. to sign the bill. Well, to the surprise of Bush, DeLay, and Frist, their involvement with Schiavo was opposed by most Americans, including evangelicals, who saw the conflict as a family dispute and not a federal case. And they thought Schiavo had the right to die with dignity, as she apparently wanted to do. Well, from then on, things went from bad to worse for Bush. Hurricane Katrina, devastated New Orleans, Michael Brown, the head of FEMA, and Bush crony managed it so ineptly that he had to resign. You've done a hell of a job, Brownie. And then Bush nominated Harriet Myers, an evangelical and his personal lawyer, to the Supreme Court, even though she had zero judicial credentials. After she badly muffed the senator's question, she had to withdraw. Iraq was in turmoil, and in a spate of scandals, from corruption to sexual misbehavior, hit Republicans in the House. Bush's attempt to semi-privatize Social Security went down to defeat, and his polls dropped precipitously. Well, during this period, the Christian right clung to Bush and got their reward of these two conservative justices. Other prominent evangelicals, however, began to detach themselves from the Christian right. They feared that evangelicals were being seen only as an adjunct of the Republican Party, and many thought that the Christian right's agenda was far too narrow. Christians, they thought, should care about poverty, race, the environment, immigration reform, and other issues. Some attacked the Christian right directly, but for the most part, these evangelical leaders protested by departing from the Christian right agenda. Rick Warren, who you've probably heard of, he's the best known evangelical pastors because of a devotional book he wrote, had sent out a letter to his fellow pastors before the 2004 election, urging them to vote against abortion and gay rights. And after it, he sent out another letter to the same people, asking them to urge Bush to double his spending on AIDS and extreme poverty around the world. It's time the church be known for what it's for rather than for what it's against, he said. At a conference in March 2005, the National Association of Evangelicals published a position paper calling upon evangelicals to seek justice for the poor, to protect human rights, to seek peace, and protect God's creation, as well as the other list of, protecting the sanctity of life and nurturing families. Richard Cizik, who was the NAE's Vice President for Governmental Affairs, took the opportunity to introduce a climate expert to educate the assembly on global warming. Well, in 2 years, and this happened very quickly, and there are many, many more incidents that I could name that happened exactly in 2005. 2 years later, the number of influential evangelicals who had publicly separated themselves from the Christian right grew exponentially. They included theologians, professors, heads of international aid agencies, ministers, and several megachurch pastors. No one knew how many there were or even how to characterize them, they had no new leader, no central organization, and no fixed set of policies or programs. Some offered simply a less politicized church, others proposed a new agenda, still others rejected the entire complex of attitudes descended from fundamentalism. For lack of a better term, these became known as the new evangelicals. Though some had been waiting for years, they have their voices heard, but they have been, most of them have been intimidated by the power of the religious right. But no more. In May 2007, Terry Falwell died, followed by others, and Dobson lamented that their passing posed a serious concern about the future of the conservative Christian movement. He was right for other movement leaders, including himself, in their 70s, were retiring, and there was no one there to replace them. The new generation of pastors had not lived through the turbulent 60s, and the culture shock had largely worn off. As for the young, few lived in an evangelical subculture as their parents had, and they went to college, they liked rock and roll. They shared many of the concerns of their peers, including environmentalism. Abortion was the defining issue, and is the defining issue for them. They're very anti-abortion, but not homosexuality. Many had grown up with openly gay friends, and long before the Supreme Court decision on gay marriage, one in three favored same-sex marriage versus one in 10 of their elders. So there's a big generation gap there. On the whole, they were more tolerant of the views of others, and 40% said a person could be moral without believing in God. That was a revolutionary thing to say. In 2009, Rick Warren declared the Christian right dead. He was correct in the sense that it was no longer a movement or even an independent entity. Its remnants survived only by making alliances with groups more powerful than they were, such as the Catholic Church on the health care bill in 2009, if you remember that. And in 2010, many of them joined the Tea Party. Surveys showed that the Tea Party supporters were disproportionately white evangelicals. This should perhaps come as no surprise because Christian conservatives, many of them Southerners, were always for smaller government and lower taxes. Well, the victory of Donald Trump and the number of evangelicals who voted for him cheered the Christian right, and his choice of his vice president and his cabinet cheered them even more. Still, the prospects for the Christian right are not good in the long term. The number of white evangelicals and their proportion of the population is decreasing for the first time. Mainline Protestants have been hemorrhaging members since the 1960s, and evangelicals attributed this to their liberal theology. But the main reason, as it turned out, was that as people became more middle class, the fewer children they had. So that had happened to the mainline Protestants, and it's now happening to the evangelicals. According to one analyst, the percentage of white evangelicals slipped from 22% to 18% between 2007 and 2014. I can't attest to the truth of that, but somebody said that. I mean, you know, the respectable pollster. Then too, Americans are becoming less religious, or rather going to church less. 35% of young Americans now say they have no religious affiliation. And the same is true of 22% of their elders. This is, you know, completely out of line with, you know, previous decades. Many of these, of course, are Catholics or mainline Protestants, but some of them are evangelicals. For example, in 2006, the Southern Baptist Convention, after years of spectacular growth, began to lose members by a small percentage every year. It had fewer baptisms, baptisms and more people leaving the church. Also, the ethnic composition of the churches are changing. The Catholic Church, for example, has lost a third of its white membership, but Latino immigrants have made up for their number, so they're still at 22% of the population, the Catholics are. Pentecostal denominations, such as the Assemblies of God, actually grew larger because of Latino immigrants. And the Southern Baptist Convention would have lost many more members had it not reached out to ethnic minorities by apologizing for slavery and founding churches for Latinos and Asians. By 2005, 7% of its membership were non-Anglo, and certainly that number is greater now. Some in the convention thought that Latino evangelicals would be socially conservative, and many of them are. But many also vote Democratic for economic reasons and because of the Republican refusal to reform the immigration system. In addition, those who have no religious affiliation, and some of them are Latinos, vote overwhelmingly for Democrats. While these changes have not really shown up in the electoral statistics in terms of evangelicals, because Latinos and the young don't vote as much as their elders or whites. As a result, the Christian right, which is now thoroughly integrated in the Republican Party, has power in many districts in the states. Just look at all the new laws restricting abortion in the states and the conflict over religious freedom versus LGBT rights in states such as North Carolina. But these changes will show up, and that's what the Republican leadership fears. Just to round this off, the culture war is certainly not over, but it may be dying away or taking a new form. In early November, before the elections, Lifeway Research, which is an evangelical outfit, asked what issues would be important to their vote. Evangelical pastors listed the personal character of the candidate, Supreme Court justices, religious freedom, abortion, everything you would imagine. However, nearly half of the lay evangelicals polled cited the economy and national security first. In other words, a plurality of white evangelicals voted for reasons that have little or nothing to do with their faith. I think this is worth thinking about. But I'm going to stop here because I want to hear your questions. He has done something, or he has at least, you know, verbally done something. You know, he can't afford not to. At least he has some support there. his lack of support in the Congress is pretty dismal. And so satisfying them in some way.
So many of the policies hurt people, are unkind. And that's what I was asking about this. Because Christoph concluded that those people don't have much empathy anyway.
Christoph is a moralist. And that's fine. I'm not. I have my own opinions, right? And I might well agree with you, but this is not a kind of a thing I would look for. I mean, you can't measure empathy. And who is it? Who are you being empathetic towards? Is it your family? Is it, you know? It's a complicated question. I think that the real point is that you have to understand what Christian right considers morality before you say they're not moral or not compassionate or something. And it's very different. It really is. But you have to know them first. Yeah.
Within the faith community, there's been a lot of effort to engage evangelicals and their leaders on climate change. A certain number have gone along, but they have, if I can use the word, been excommunicated by the cult of evangelical leaders. What is it that prevents evangelicals, having this frame in terms of God's creation, from recognizing climate change as real and an issue that should be addressed?
Well, I can only... only one of them is really excommunicated, and it wasn't for that either. No, this the effort goes on in a small way. I think that it was stalled, I think largely because of the recession. People just didn't have time to think about the future. They had to worry about what was happening to their pocketbooks right then. So that's part of it. The people, Richard Cizik and others who began this, knew that they were going to have a tough time because there's an innate distrust of science because of belief in the Bible. Not all evangelicals, but fundamentalists at least, believe that Genesis 1 is absolutely true, and that the earth began 10,000 years ago. So once you start with that, getting to climate change is a good deal harder. And then they still associate climate change with tree huggers and hippies and so forth, long after it ceased to have any relevance at all. We'll see what happens now, because Trump is so against it himself, and the business reasons to be against it. But will these liberal progressive evangelicals start talking out again? Be interesting to see. Yes.
Jimmy Carter described himself as a born again Christian, and how did he do when he ran for the presidency in 76 and 80 with evangelicals?
He carried this out in 76. He did very well. He's a Southern Baptist, and he's very pious, and he teaches Sunday school even now. I saw a very exciting event he put on. It's called the New Baptist Covenant, and he brought together thousands of Baptists, both black and white, for the first time in history, in this convention hall. And you should have heard the preaching. It was amazing. the second time he didn't do so well, because it's essentially people, I really think that that evangelicals have never exactly voted because of somebody's religion, They look for what the presidential candidate can do. And if you're a blank slate in the beginning, and born
churches themselves seem to operate as a surrogate for other institutions because the blacks are disenfranchised. And you know, things like the YMCA becomes a de facto hotel. But the churches, again, a surrogate for even governmental but other institutions. The evangelical churches provide some commodity beyond just the religious part? Are they providing a community or connection?
Oh, certainly always community. But the mega churches are particularly good at this. It's not just a community, it's baseball leagues and lessons at various times and swimming competitions. That's how they partly how they attract people, and in some sense it's valuable because most of them are in the suburbs, which don't have any community institutions in the beginning. So they created them, and mega churches are not all one political flavor at all. They're all over the place.
How did you decide which churches to visit? I was in the South last week, and I Googled evangelical churches, on Google Maps near the city I was in, and there were so many.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard. I went to churches where there were important pastors. That was one of them. But sometimes it was just by chance, that I found a church I just drove by in Connecticut, in New Milford, and this preacher was just starting what he hoped to be a mega church, and he was selling it like crazy, and so he was really glad to have me around because the New Yorker do good things for him. And funnily enough, it did because Simon & Schuster, which is my publisher, has a religious subsidiary, and they took two of his books. So it worked out well for him. But this was just by chance. I had no idea who he was or what was going on, but it was fascinating.
Thank you.
One more question.
Oh, okay.
Yes, please. Yes, go right ahead.
Oh. No. Me, I can't tell whether you're pointing to me or somebody.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, go ahead. Get you both.
Can you tell us anything about evangelicals and foreign policy issues? Do they matter at all to them at times of elections, besides patriotism and the usual banalities? I mean, are they strongly in favor of this rather than that, or is that something that hasn't really come out?
Not until the crisis of some sort or another. Terrorism worries them, the Middle East worries them, but missions still worry them, but obviously there are a lot of sophisticated people in this group, but for the sort of base, the lay base, that they're not normally worried about foreign policy. Well, okay, one more.
Can you comment on any anti-Semitism among evangelicals?
Oh, yes. mainly Christian, right? I was completely surprised by it because Fulham always made an effort to try and include Jews in Judeo-Christian and so. And that has become the mantra now. People don't say just Christian, they say Judeo-Christian normally. But among lay people, it's kind of primitive. They always make more money and stuff like that.
Thank you so much.
Hi.
This was Gerald's willing to sign books. If any of you would like to have your copy signed, come to the front of the room. Thank you.